For look, Jehovah is breaking out of his place in order to bring down and trample the high places of worship of the land. Jehovah is breaking out of his place. Micah chapter 1, verse 3 of the 7 chapters of Micah. And this is the version of yours truly, little children, from 2003. And that's our daily scripture for today. We have, once again, some more work in our study here of the article, the Ark of Urartu, the Orient Express. We're in part 2, chapter 12, and now paragraph 4. Mr. Jacob Bryant thus joins Mr. David Allen Deal, who is a wellhead ward of the modern-day understanding of Noah's Ark, in mapping most miracles of the historic details. Other great contributions have been made since Jesus by Mr. Ron Wyatt, Mr. Flavius Josephus, and Mr. David Fasthold. Before them, Berosus, the Chaldean historian and astronomer, wrote, he flourished from 290 to 278 BCE. And before all of these was Moses, the holy penman, to whom transmission of the Bible account of the ark landing is attributed. That is Genesis chapters 8 and 9. And who is placed by us as living from 1572 to 1452 BCE. Noah or his sons may have written about their landing from 3281 BCE, with the deluge taking up about 1 year. Problems in maneuvering the ark to a final haven are considered by Mr. Wyatt and Mr. Deal separately and at some length, the latter using the work of his predecessor. But Mr. Deal's work is somewhat unique too. He's saying that Gilgamesh means revealer of Misha. Compare Misha with the word Messiah. M-E-S-H or M-S-H being the only consonants in both of them, with there being a double S, of course, in Messiah. But the Mr. Deal, his discovery of the Ark's imprint at the, quote, place of first ascent, end quote. Now that's interesting, the Ark's imprint in the earth. Very heavy vessel would make an imprint. And the incorporation of the Gilgamesh epic into the overall understanding by him was a tour de force. Mr. David Allen Deal, his work that referred to. Now, Gilgamesh lived 1,200 years before Moses, 2,700 compared to about 1,500, and was described as two-thirds God and one-third human, a kind of demigod. The biblical flood account in the Epic of Gilgamesh was discovered. In the Epic of Gilgamesh, in 1872, by George Smith, the British Museum assistant who in that moment, quote, began to undress himself, end quote. On Mashu, the mountain, the Epic of Gilgamesh says, quote, the name of the mountain is Mashu. Mashu protects the daily departure of Shamash. The roof of the sky is braced upon it, supported upon its weight and strength, like a lintel. A mantle of frightening radiance surrounds it. The Epic of Gilgamesh by John Harris from 2001, pages 47 and 48. That was from Gilgamesh was looking for Utnapishtim, or Noah, who by the book, meaning the Bible, lived 350 years after the deluge to 2932 BCE. Berosus mentioned a Sesuthris, who reigned 18 sari, and the 120 sari prior to the deluge, taken as 2268 years by us, the total time, in other words, from Adam to the deluge in our genealogy, gives 18.9 years per saros. Now, the actual length of a saros, as measured by astronomers, is today about 18.03 years. And that would result in there being 125 sari prior to the deluge, back to the time of Adam. So it's still, but it's still a number reasonably approximating 120 sari, isn't it? But if we take our 18.9 years per saros and we determine, based on the 350 years that Noah lived after the deluge, we divide the 350 by the number of years per saros, we get the number of saros, right? Which is 18.52, to round that off. 18.52. Sari, which is very close to the number given by Berosus as 18 sari for the reign of the man he called Sesuthris, who is mentioned in the flood account in the Epic of Gilgamesh as the one the one whom we call Noah, right? He's the same person, the one who was in charge of navigating the ark, building it, and surviving the flood. He was in charge. So Sesuthris ruled, he said 18 sari. That would be after the deluge, if that's the equivalent to the 350 years. And it lines up just about perfect. So Noah survived or ruled 350 years after the deluge. Heracles, Gilgamesh, and Nimrod become one and the same in the account of Mr. Deal. We talked about this a little earlier, too, about comparing Heracles with Nimrod, and talked about Gilgamesh in association with those two also, I believe, didn't we? And the mountain ridge identified by Mr. Deal as At Mashu of the Epic of Gilgamesh, Mashu is the name of the mountain in the Epic of Gilgamesh, as we saw just a few moments ago, right? In the quote from the book by Mr. Harris. And the mountain ridge identified by Mr. Deal as being right there at Mashu of the Epic of Gilgamesh lies to the east of the Ark landing site by 1,290 feet. Okay, what's that in meters? How many meters? I'm trying to think. We can calculate the number of a meter. Let's see. A foot is 30 point. No, I'm not even sure. Do I know that? Okay, let's figure it out from first principles. An inch is 2.54 centimeters times 12. 30.48 is the number of centimeters in a foot. So multiply that times 1290. 30.48 times 1290 is the number of centimeters divided by 100 to get meters. So 1,290 feet is 393 meters, about 400 meters. And that mountain that was 400 meters to the east of the Ark landing site would indeed provide it protection from the rising sun. And that's the end of our study article. Mashu protects the daily departure of Shamash. What is Shamash? Is that the sun? I'm trying to think. Trying to remember if I know that or not. Let's look up Shamash. Have we even talked about it here? Right. The sun god Shamash, in the article by yours truly called True. One word, True, is the name of that article. And there it is, the sun god Shamash. We mentioned it in that article, that Shamash is the sun god. Okay, so protects the daily departure of the sun. This mountain, that's interesting. So that's what that quote was saying there. And since the Ark is to the west of the mountain, it protects the Ark from the morning sun. So that's how that is evidently meant to be interpreted. That's it for today's study, as I said. So we've got like 20 more minutes here. A lot of time. So, yeah, my heart rate fell yesterday. By the end of the day, it had fallen to 54 beats per minute, which is phenomenal. I don't think I even had less than 60 beats before. And this morning, when I was measuring it, lying in bed, at sometimes during the early morning, whatever you call it. Actually, it was the daytime because I went to bed at 9:14 in the morning. Oh, it's milk. I'm just going to see what happens to my heart rate because I'm increasing my vitamin D a little bit again, quite a bit, but not back to what it had been. And so it's around. Let me see, what was it? Let's see, 4 times. It might be 25K now, 25,000 units of vitamin D today that I took. I think that's the right number, but whatever, it's a lot less than what I was taking. But it's a lot more than what I took yesterday. And after I took it, my heart rate didn't change significantly at all, not immediately anyway. So and later on, when I had my tea, which has some sugar in it, that causes an increase in heart rate. So it went up to 78 at some point. Right now, what is it? Oh, it's 72 right now. Yeah, it's very good. And I'm drinking milk, so that's really good. My heart rate is really good right now. Sometimes I have a weaker heart rate if I don't take calcium, too. So it makes it hard to even feel or to measure my pulse. That's what I found after I didn't take any calcium yesterday. When I was measuring my pulse, I could barely feel it. And I even got the illusion that it was only 30 beats per minute, which it could have been. Actually, that could have been the correct measurement. Might have only been 30 beats per minute. Or it was sort of intermittent beating, which is... I've noticed that when I deprived myself of all calcium and vitamin D before. Since I just bumped up the vitamin D again today after I made those measurements of my pulse, then that could have caused, because of the lack of calcium. And I've been excreting a lot of calcium in the urine because it's very milky white at the beginning of the effluent flow, right, of the flow. Very white at the beginning. And that, by the way, is not need for concern or cause for concern about kidney stones, because even though I worry about that, because the book, The Calcium Factor, talked about experts, the best experts, who said that it's not calcium supplements that cause kidney stones, and that's what the common misconception is, in fact, but by the way, which is pretty obvious why, because if you take, because kidney stones are made of calcium, and if you take supplements of calcium, many people worry that that causes kidney stones. But in fact, it's not about the calcium, it's about the alkalization of the body, which calcium provides. And it's when you're deficient in calcium that you get kidney stones, because your bones start to dissolve to replace the lack of calcium in the body. That calcium gets in the blood, and then it gets, that can be called hypercalcemia, when you have a huge amount of calcium in the blood. And that goes to the kidneys and is excreted, but because the body is acidic, because of lack of calcium, that's when kidney stones form in the kidneys and get caught on the way out and trapped and cause all kinds of pain and misery for people who are suffering from kidney stones. So, yeah, I mean, this is the important reason why you should take calcium supplements, is to prevent kidney stones, in fact. That's according to the experts, not according to me, because I have the same fear as everyone else. I'm afraid I'm going to get kidney stones, but I'm listening to the experts. I know the benefits of calcium far outweigh any risk. So it's not just about kidney stones, calcium. It's about every phenomenal, every, practically every process in the body is regulated by calcium, even the hormone production, everything. But just hundreds of processes. Calcium is the worker of this workhorse, they say, of the cell. It carries, you know, up to 100 nutrients at one time, I believe they said. That it carries many nutrients, let's say. I don't think it's 100 at one time, not for one calcium atom, but maybe it does. It's something phenomenal. But calcium carries the nutrients into the cell through the calcium channel. So then when you have, let's not get into the, you know, the use of any unnatural substances that people administer in the field of allopathic treatment. I'm interested in orthomolecular medicine, which is the use of harmless, you know, natural substances, essentially harmless anyway. Very hard to overdose on these substances. In fact, the only overdose I've ever seen of any vitamin has been when taking large amounts, like in excess of 50,000 units of vitamin D3 as a supplement, and combining that with massive amounts, like I'm thinking over 2,000 units of calcium per day, 2,000 milligrams. So that would be over 2 grams if you want to do it that way. But 2,000, over 1,500, let's say, milligrams of calcium with tens of thousands of units of vitamin D. That's when you can overdose on calcium. And I know it at least happened once to an extreme degree, where I got... because I was taking almost 1 million units of vitamin D, and I was drinking my well water, which is just laced with calcium, and it was unfiltered. It was 400 units, 400, what is it, milligrams, yeah, 400 milligrams per liter is what my well water is, something like that, of calcium. Essentially all of it's calcium, although there are other things. So it's just a huge amount of calcium, 300 or 400 milligrams of calcium per liter, and I'm drinking a ton of it at the time because I'm dehydrated, because I'm overdosed on calcium at the same time. That's what happened to me the first time. And I learned my lesson, so, but then I'm still trying to find out how much do I need to take of vitamin D? How much is safe? So I pushed it a bit too far there because I started drinking a lot of this beautiful organic milk. And I think maybe the cows are different because the lectins, I think it's the lectins, or no, maybe it's not, maybe it's some other. It's not lectins in the milk, is it? It's a protein in the milk. There's a type 1 or type A protein and type B protein in different cows. And one of them causes arthritis. And in North America, the one that causes arthritis is far more common than it is in Europe. But there may be a few cows in North America, I believe there are, that produce the type B protein that doesn't cause problems for people. But it's also got to do with digestion and the problem with digesting the milk, because recently when I bought the organic milk, which is hard to get, they don't have it in stock all the time where I'm shopping at a small local store here. And it's expensive, very expensive milk. Like it's about more than triple or double or triple, I don't know, quadruple the price, whatever, of the regular milk. But this is, and I love high fat milk. I love sheep's milk, goat's milk. Sheep's milk is better than goat's milk if it's higher fat. Anything that's like 5%, 6% fat, milk, if it's milk that is 6%, is better, because especially if it's grass fed, because all the vitamins are in the fat. These, fat soluble vitamins like vitamin K2, it's fat soluble, but it's not toxic like other fat-soluble vitamins, such as vitamin D, which is toxic if you take too much. Like I've been finding out, I'm trying to find out how much vitamin D I can take. But you want as much fat as possible in your dairy products, but milk is by far the best because there's no calcium in the fat, right? It's in the milk. So you want the calcium with the vitamin K2. You want the fat and the milk. High fat is good. You don't need to drink gallons of it either. Because especially if you're taking a significant amount of vitamin D, like, 60,000 units of vitamin D with a tiny amount of calcium, it's probably going to give you enough calcium. Or, and there's lots of calcium in milk. There's very little calcium in cream. And there might be a lot of vitamin K2 in the cream. That's the benefit. If it's grass-fed, only if it's grass-fed. So how much have we used of our time? About 10 minutes of the time that we had, which was 20 minutes. I've got this organic milk, and it doesn't harm me. Like, it doesn't cause mucus in my throat. Even when I eat salad, sometimes I get mucus in the throat. It might be from the Parmesan cheese and the cow's milk that was made with. When I put Parmesan in the salad, I haven't noticed whether I get it without that. Without the cheese. But it's typically dairy that causes the mucus buildup if it's the wrong kind of cows. At least that. But cow's milk, you see, is not as good as goat's or sheep's milk. Sheep's and goat's are equally good. And I even like the sheep's better if it's higher fat. I mean, I love the taste of it, too. It's more flavorful than cow's milk. Both of them are. Goat's milk, sheep's milk are more flavorful than cow's milk. But the other thing... What was I trying to say? The organic, the cow's milk causes the mucus buildup, right? But it might cause arthritis. And the mucus buildup is a telltale sign that the cow's milk is harder to digest for the humans, right? Now, humans are different from cows because we have one stomach, and a cow has multiple stomachs, and, chews the cud from one stomach, all these things in the cow's metabolism differ from humans, whereas goats and sheep, they have one stomach, they're like us. So their milk is much more similar to human milk, and it's more readily assimilated by the human organism. So we can say they're far preferable, goats and sheep. But now if I'm drinking this organic milk and I see a lot of benefit and no harm, then I'm going to say, well, there are some cows maybe that you can drink their milk and it's not going to be a factor, but I think it's still suspicious because cows are not like humans because they have, like I said, multiple stomachs, right? So, but this, the organic milk is very sweet, extremely sweet. Yeah, we could talk about lactose intolerance too, but there's a lot of things that are misconceptions about that too. I just am not prepared to give a talk about that right now, but lactose is a sugar like glucose. It's very similar. These are 6-carbon sugars, whereas xylitol is a 5-carbon sugar alcohol. It's not quite sugar because it has one less carbon atom per molecule. And because xylitol is similar to sugar but different by one carbon atom per molecule, the bacteria think that xylitol is just like sugar. It looks like sugar. It's got the, you know, to them it looks similar, so they eat this xylitol, but then it kills them. Okay? And that's why xylitol is so good at preventing cavities, because it's the bacteria that cause the cavities and, you know, cause the tartar buildup. So when you have enough xylitol in your mouth, when you chew that gum, the xylitol gum, or I mean, it's always got to be xylitol gum or xylitol gargling or xylitol that you're eating. Just xylitol or erythritol works just as well for the dental, or better actually for the dental part. But it's not as good at killing strep throat. And, you know, erythritol is not as good in producing the short-chain fatty acids. Yesterday I called them saturated. They're not saturated. They're short-chain. That's what I was trying to remember. But I guess I just got a little bit ahead of myself. The short-chain fatty acids, or short-chain fatty acids in the intestine produced by xylitol. And they're very beneficial to health. I just got a tickle in my throat and wondering if this is a reaction, a negative reaction to the cow's milk. I don't know. I haven't reacted to it before, so I don't think that's necessarily what it is. But if we're going to be giving ourselves our own care and looking after our own supplementation and food and all that, we have to pay attention to everything we eat. We have to write down the amounts of everything we take with regard to supplements. We have to keep track in our own minds, at least, but it's better if we can write down all the food we're eating too, but I can usually remember what I've been eating. So whatever we can do, you know, with regard to keeping track, we need to be diligent if we're going to be looking after ourselves. And, the you know, if we're going to avoid allopathic treatment and go with orthomolecular treatment, which is far more friendly, like the use of vitamin C. Let's come back to that. The only problem with vitamin C is to kill strep, you have to take a massive amount of it. It's not that pleasant to take it, but I'll take it if I have to. But if I can kill the strep by gargling xylitol, that's far easier, and it's beneficial because xylitol, like I said, if you do swallow a little bit of it, when it gets into your intestines, it produces short-chain fatty acids, which are highly beneficial. And erythritol doesn't do that, the other sugar alcohol that's so good for dental health, but not so good for killing strep either. Now, the cavities are caused by one form of strep, generally, for the most part, but the strep throat is caused by a different kind of strep bacteria. So, you know, you might have both kinds in your mouth and both kinds in your throat, right? Of this strep bacterium, which is a very probably beneficial too in the intestines, strep. I mean, a lot of bacteria are beneficial in the intestines. We don't know. But when they're in the throat or in the mouth, they're not always very beneficial because they can cause cavities or strep throat, right? Now, xylitol can kill all the strep that's causing the issues with the mouth, like the dental issues, and it probably even cures bad breath, I would think, because it kills all the bad bacteria. It kills everything bad, according to what people are saying. And what doesn't, the only question I have about xylitol is what does it not cure? Because there's so many things that xylitol cures that if there is a panacea at all in the world for human health, I think it might qualify as being one, or the one. It is so good, like xylitol. And I was very afraid at first to take it, you know, because, of course, it does cause the death of dogs very easily if dogs take any xylitol. It's not a good thing for dogs. It's something to be aware of. But for humans, it's not like that. It doesn't seem as bad. It does cause diarrhea, you know, in fairly low quantities, so you want to be careful eating it. But at least for some people, it, probably more than others anyway, but in my case, I have a very low tolerance to it, as far as the bowel tolerance goes for xylitol. So I try to just gargle it and occasionally maybe eat it, swallow a little bit of it. And really, it seems to have eliminated my throat problem, my sore throat problems. All of them just have gone away when I gargle with it. So that's my experience. But all, like I said, the list of things that it does, I have a lot more experience because I chew the xylitol also. I chew 6 pieces of xylitol gum every time I think I need to during the day, you know, probably from at least maybe once a day up to 5 times a day I might do that if I'm eating a lot of foods that I think could cause tooth decay. But I don't have to do that if I'm gargling. You don't have to do it as much, so... If I'm gargling the xylitol as well, which I tend to be doing now in the winter, to prevent, you know, strep or other throat infections, I think it may even prevent a lot of other throat infections if there are others besides strep. I don't think I know of any others, but there. Okay, so let's get into, I'm sure someone does, let's get into the other, what doesn't xylitol do, because it is so beneficial for skin, they were saying in that article. Maybe we have a minute to look at the skin again and what xylitol does for skin. It's all the benefits of xylitol beyond dental health. What does it do? Because it's excellent for dental health. Oh, it actually relieves constipation and improves bone mineral density. Oh my goodness, what on earth? I mean, that's a huge problem. Bone mineral density is associated with osteoporosis, right? So that's it for today, though, I think. But I wanted to find something about skin. Just read this. I'll leave that on the page. We're just about done, though. I don't know what we can say here. Reduces skin irritation right there is one thing. That's it for today, though. It's January 15th. 2025 of the Common Era, and the time is 1956 hours Canadian Eastern Time, and I'm Ward Green. Thank you so much for listening and watching, and I love you very much. This is Sissy, and this is Star saying bye for now. That was chapter 12 today, paragraph 4, was it? Yeah, I think it was paragraph 4. Yeah, it's paragraph 4 of chapter 12 of the Acroviratina.